aggregated live
stream. Yes, yes. I wanted to. Yes. Okay. Now, so yes, these are just elementary steps for now. Now, here we. The standard. Now, here. So, our ideology in Islam, we want to learn a worldview which is irfani and philosophical. That's the worldview we want to preserve. If we don't preserve that in the West, we're going to suffer. Also, that we want to propagate has to be the irfani worldview too. If we don't, and suffice with the zahiri aspect, we're going to suffer also in propagation. Until now, that much I've tried to illustrate, albeit briefly. Now, when it comes to our relations with agnostics, atheists, Jews, Christians, and other Islamic denominations, here, how should we preserve this ideology? With each one, there may be differing mechanisms. But Islam in the Holy Quran, there's one very delicate verse. And this verse is a practical guide and instruction. If you've understood nothing else, if you just try to understand this one practical procedural step, you'll benefit, inshallah. And it's a verse that you've all heard of, but due to certain mistranslations, and if not mistranslations, limited versions, you may not have paid heed to the essence of what the verse wants to say. The verse is chapter 49, number 13, verse number 13. O mankind, indeed we have created you from male and female. So it's addressing mankind again. It's that humanitarian. Whenever the Quran says, Ya ayyuha al-insan, it's a fitri. It's a providential order given. It's for all man. And made you peoples and tribes, lita'arafu, so that you may know one another. Now here in the West, it applies to the agnostics and atheists. We want to know one another, deal with one another. It Jews, Christians, other religions, and other Muslims. So you've created from male and female and made you peoples and tribes so that you may know one another. The point now we're trying to open is give us a tool, a device, so that we can maximally know one another in the best possible way. That's the aim here. Then it says, Inna akramakum inda Allah atqakum. Verily, the most dignifying amongst you are the atqa amongst you. Now, who are the atqa? Usually they translate it as those with taqwa. Okay? But when it says the most dignifying amongst you, taqwa is embedded in the dignified. So that would be just repeating the same thing again. The most dignifying amongst you, to be dignified, you must have taqwa. Who are they? The ones with taqwa. It's like, you know, kind of a fallacy, repeating itself again. So, although it can be justified, but there is something much more important at stake in this verse. First of all, why does the verse say the most dignifying amongst you? Okay. So first of all, you have to be dignifying. And when you want to be dignifying, it's in what purpose, with what objective are you being dignifying here? It's with the purpose to know one another with other people in all walks of life. The aim here, the objective is to know one another in peace, in tranquility, in friendship. In this knowing one another, you have to be dignifying. But the level of being more dignifying depends on an important prerequisite. And that is, you have to be atqa. Now, what does this atqa mean? This is very pivotal now, because here is something that we can all benefit from practically. Okay, who are the atqa and how do we become one of them? So does everyone get the main gist? Because if the main question is, we want to know one another, at the same time we want to preserve ourselves, but we want to have relations with everyone. That is an aim the Quran is saying. To do that, we have to be dignifying. How can we be maximally dignifying? The answer is to be more and more atqa. But who are the atqa? And how do we become it? That's the whole issue now. Okay, how to execute taqiyya? See, atqa is the plural of taqi. And this is having taqiyya. Now, taqiyya doesn't necessarily, we don't need to limit it to the fiqhi taqiyya, where your life is at stake. And then you conceal, that's what taqiyya means, a form of withdrawing from, hiding something. And then if your life is at stake, so that you don't die or whatever, here you conceal your faith. That is one form of taqiyya in the fiqhi sense. But this concealing and taqiyya is a much broader concept in the ethical and non-fiqhi sense. And here the Quran is mentioning it, not necessarily only in the fiqhi sense. It's referring to the term in the absolute sense. So there's a kind of concealing that has to be done in order for you to be more dignifying. Now, what is that concealing? That's what I'm trying to, what I hope to try and open. So first of all, ultimate fruit to be sought is that unity between people. We know one another, we live with one another, we cohabit with one another in the best possible way. When Allah instructs two prophets, Nabi Musa and Nabi Harun, to go to Pharaoh, who was the tyrant of the times, Allah says, speak, you two, speak with him. Faqula lahu, him being the Pharaoh, a gentle or a smooth or a lenient speaking. Qawlan layyana. This layyana I'm translated as gentle or smooth. To understand that concealing taqiyya in the broad sense, the key to understanding that is to understand what this layyana, this gentleness, actually involves. We have to be gentle when we deal with others, whoever they are, each in a different way. But this gentleness has side effects if not executed properly. There's a negative form of compromising and being gentle. And there's a positive form of compromising and being gentle. Okay? But the socio-political ethical ramifications in either case is very significant. The negative form of compromising, the negative form of being gentle, I want to reject. But the positive form of compromising and the positive ramifications that a positive form of gentleness brings, that I want to put forward. The negative compromising first. That's when there's a negative compromise of one's ideology and one's belief. And we'll speak more about that in a minute. The positive form of compromising, which we're calling coping now. If I keep on using the same word, you may get mixed up. A positive form of coping. And that's when you cope with, you tolerate a given status quo for X period for a bigger goal. But you don't change your beliefs. Okay? With the negative, you're ready to even change your beliefs. That is not allowed. But with the positive form of coping, you're coping a given status quo. without changing your beliefs for a given time, but you have a bigger picture in mind. That's important. Now, that which is prohibited in Islam is approving vice and falsehood. You're not allowed to approve, confirm that this vice is good or nothing wrong with it, or something which is a falsehood. You're not allowed to approve of it. That's a definite. Also prohibited in Islam is abandoning the denying of vice and falsehood. You can't abandon that either. Now, these two are prohibited when? When are they prohibited? Are they prohibited in absolute terms? Or in certain circumstances, to certain degrees, can they be executed? Here, that which is prohibited in Islam is when you approve of vice and falsehood, or you abandon denying vice and falsehood, when? With the intention of greed and self-interest towards others' worldly benefits. It's an important step here. That you are ready not to go against falsehood, or you're ready even to approve falsehood. Why? Because you're looking at your own self-interest. You have greed and avarice towards worldly benefits, be it capital, knowledge, accommodation, whatever. And as a result of those self-interests and your greed, you're ready to abandon denying falsehood. Or, even worse, you're ready to approve of falsehood. And if they were to ask you why you're doing these two, deep down the answer is self-interest or greed. That is a definite negative form of gentleness, a negative form of compromising that no one accepts. Okay? So the first criterion is this, that with the intention of greed and self-interest towards worldly benefits, you can't approve or abandon denying vice and falsehood. In this domain, gentleness is not acceptable. Just on the side note, there are two approaches here, a bottoms-up or a tops-down approach. Here, what I mean by bottoms-up, it means disseminating the message of Islam from grassroots, working upwards towards the top. Or top-down, disseminating from the kings and presidents, you preach to them, and then you work yourself downwards. With the first, it starts with the people, grassroots level. For example, you go and preach the message there, either as a preacher or as a local governor, a local councillor, a mayor. Look, whether you want it or not, Muslims in America is going to keep on becoming more and more. If we don't become local councillors, local governors, who's going to come? Who's going to decide our destiny for us? So here, it's a very good step, even for the youth, to be involved at a grassroots level. There's no need to think about going and meeting presidents, senators, as a first step, or trying to trying to speak about Islam to presidents or kings. You work with a grassroots level, with people. Once you master that and you acquire support, then you can move up. And then you can gradually move up the echelons. But you work from the group, from down. Some people have tried working from the top with the king of the time, with the president of the time, with the prime minister of the time, with the aim they had was that if we can convince the king, the president, or whatever, then we can automatically, if they're convinced, everyone beneath them will be effective. This isn't the way the Islamic Sharia works. And it's not the Muhammadan way when you look at his lifestyle. And this has a lot of complications with it, and it can cause a lot of side effects. In the last two or three decades in America, elsewhere, we've had examples. It hasn't turned out well. You can't do this individually. For a scholar to go to the top level and speak with presidents or prime ministers, he needs the backing of the grassroots people. If it goes and does this alone, it won't work. And it can have a very adversary effect too. He has to be with the people. If he does it in isolation from the people, and it's a one-man endeavor, it's going to be very difficult. Some Sharias had this, and maybe there may be exceptions. With, for example, Prophet Suleiman went to the queen of Sheba, Bilqis. Yes, he went right to the top. It started there. There may be exceptions today too for that to be supported. But the common route is from the grassroots level. And today, something very important that we have to think about these things on how to enter the political system. And were we to enter it, it would be from, you have to start from the beginning. And I'm not sure what the beginning is here, but as a local councillor or governor, yes, what's the problem? You enter and you serve not only your fellow Muslims, but your fellow non-Muslim Americans, and let them see you in action, how you're serving them. Act as an ambassador, as a model, but grassroots, not high, not yet. When the time will come, you'll know when to enter a higher level, but for now, only grassroots, that level. And you know, you can serve Islam much more as a local councillor, or even subjects and sciences which deal with the grassroots, such as journalism, media studies, all these different things. You can serve Islam much more in this way than a doctor or an engineer today, especially in the West. Because as a doctor or engineer, even assuming you're not doing it for money, what you're doing for Islam is very limited in the West. Unless, let's say, you go maybe in impoverished areas and really create a universal protocol of, you know, immunization that hasn't been there before, or in the microbiological, you know, these infections, you do something really significant that saves a lot of people. Okay, yes. But otherwise, it's a very limited, and you become very comfortable in your own clinic. Or with an engineer, you become very comfortable with all these contracts. There's no Allah in the picture over a period of time. But with the media studies, journalism, politics, the influence you can have, is the potential is very great now, especially in the West, especially in America. And so this has to be started. And, you know, it's going to happen anyway. If you don't do it as abiding Muslims, non-abiding Muslims will do it. But the fact it's going to happen, it's inevitable. So we have to try and shift this how it happens to the best of our capacity. Yet in the case of Iran, we saw it with Imam Khomeini. He started with grassroots, with the people. There were scholars at the same time, Ayatollahs at the same time, when Imam was working with the people, they were trying to guide the Shah of the time. And it went hectically wrong. For them, for the Shah, everything. It was a big mess. And it caused a lot of, you know, problems. So this is the safer route. Okay, now let's go to the positive form of gentleness. Because gentleness has a negative form. Or just, you let be. Be gentle with them. Approve of vice and falsehood. Abandon denying vice and falsehood. Yes, that kind of gentleness, no. But there's a positive gentleness which entails a positive form of coping. Now, this involves adapting now to a certain status quo for a period of time. Now, the intention is not self-interest now. It's not vice. It's not greed. the intention for adapting to a certain status quo for a period of time is either to prevent a vice happening, if it means to adapt to a certain status quo, but the intention is to prevent something bad happening, it's okay. Cope with that status quo. It may be negative, but you're preventing something bad happening. Or you're reducing a vice's effects. That's assuming you can't eliminate it. If it's substantiated before you, you can eliminate a vice. You have to go and eliminate it. But if you can't, then adapt to a certain status quo with the intention of reducing that vice's effects. Or adapt and cope, tolerate a given status quo with the intention of reducing the rate of that vice's permeation in community. By you tolerating the status quo, the rate at which this vice is spreading is reduced. And if your coping can reduce that rate, that's okay. It's a positive form of gentleness. Here, in this form, coping entails you preventing yourself from denying the vice. Okay? In this form of coping, which is a positive form of coping, you don't deny the vice. There's a vice which is happening. You don't deny it. Usually you have to deny that vice, as we said before. But for a given moment of time, you're adapting to the status quo. You don't deny the vice. Why? Because A or B or C. This is very clinical here. Not because of your self-interests. Not because of your greed. It's because of you want either A or B or C to be actualized. And to do that, for a period of time, you're denying the vice, which normally wouldn't be acceptable. But with this intention, bringing about A, B, or C, it becomes legitimate. And this is a positive form of coping. It's a form of taqiyya here, because you're refraining from denying the vice. So it's a form of taqiyya. You're concealing something. But you're doing it with this intention, not for greed, not for self-interests. It's for the best interest of the community. A, B, or C. That's why you're doing it. And secondly, you cope if and only if you can't eliminate the vice in its entirety in the first place. If that's not possible, you go back to step one again, preventing yourself from denying the vice. Because if you can eliminate a vice, you have to do it. And it's substantiated before you that it is. You can eliminate it. So if you can eliminate it, you have to eliminate it. But if you can't, then taqiyya comes into play, concealing. And this taqiyya, using it in the broad sense, not the fiqhi sense, involves a positive form of coping and adapting. You're not compromising with your beliefs. There's no greed. You're working in the best interests of the ummah. The Hudaybiyah Treaty of the Holy Messenger was this kind of coping. Imam Hassan's, alayhi salam's, treaty, that peace treaty with the tyrant of the time, involves this positive coping. What they did to Lady Fatima, alayha salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen was there. But for the sake of Islam and what the Holy Messenger had told him will happen after, but said, you be patient. It all falls onto this category. It's a positive form of adapting. It's a positive form of coping, tolerating for a given time. What that time span is, we don't know until you know it can be eliminated. With the story of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Islam was under threat. It's a form of taqiyya that happened. with Imam Hassan and many stories. This is taqiyyah, this positive coping with a certain status quo. The most dignifying amongst you are those who practice this. And those who practice this lesser or don't even practice this, they believe they should come and shout and say whatever they want and cause disunity and deaths among so many Muslims and non-Muslims, they are the least dignifying of people. I don't want to enter the particularities, but many Islamic uprisings that happen and have happened and that have led to the deaths of many Muslims, who's going to answer for the deaths of those Muslims? It was monitored badly. It was controlled badly. I know the examples, but it'll cause a lot of sensitivity. I don't want people to be sidetracked. Who's going to answer for those hundreds or thousands of Muslims who were killed in that uprising? For what? For what were they killed? Was there any positive form of coping? Couldn't that have been executed? Shiism has always been born through the margins. From the very beginning, it always grew through the margins. And when the grassroots level reaches a certain threshold and it becomes substantiated that the support of all the people are there, we go for a revolution. Before that, it makes no sense. Dignifying amongst you are those who are atqa. And this is very difficult. It's very difficult to do this. And then many people go against this. They go against unity. Why do they go against unity? If you go deep down, see what the reasons are. So coping is an application of taqiyyah. Why is it more dignifying? I've tried to answer that. And one has to look at always the bigger picture. And the reality is that most people fail. It's not an easy task to do taqiyyah here. It's not an easy task to just abandon denying the vice. It's difficult. Because people say, no, Islam, we have to come and say everything. But the bigger picture should never be lost. Now, can me and you ascertain what that bigger picture is or the authority of the times? And that's why it's important to believe in an authority. Last night's lecture. It's not something that everyone can do for themselves. This is a very tricky area. You have to go to the experts. Okay, now these are now a few just examples now. I've given you the main point which I wanted to share with you. It was that positive form of gentleness. But now let's go through the different groups of people. When you encounter agnostics and atheists, first course of action is compassion. Al-Hubbu Asasi, the Holy Messenger said, love is my first course of action. My prime course of action is love with all people. Even in the Quran, when he was that compassion with the mushrikeen, Allah said, no, you're killing yourself. Stop. All people, all things, animals, plants, everything, that compassion has to be there. Treat them with as your fellow Americans, brothers or sisters. Lead by example as an ambassador for Islam. Always remember, actions speak louder than words. Act. Try not to speak about Islam to them. You just act as a true Muslim. And if they approached you with a question, you say, I don't know. Let me ask a scholar. Unless you do know, and even if you do know, give the reference. Don't speak unreferenced. Don't bring about, you know, just your own interpretations of Islam. It causes problems. Now, assuming you fear that your faith will be compromised, yes, try to isolate yourself from agnostics and atheists. If that isn't, you know, a fear that you have, people are different. Let's not judge one another. If someone has that weakness, then that weakness he or she has, and they don't want to, and you shouldn't push them. And those who have that weakness shouldn't think that other people are like them. Maybe other people don't have that weakness. They can freely intermingle and nothing happens. Their deen is not compromised. Everyone to themselves. Refrain from the theist-atheist dialogue. Most of these kind of dialogues are just the ego trying to dominate the other one. It's not for Allah's sake. There's no need. If you want to learn how to enter a dialogue, you go and see how Imam Jawad alayhi salam entered dialogue with different denominations. You'll be shocked the way he used sentences. No one uses those kind of approaches today. If I were to use the dialogue of Imam Jawad alayhi salam in certain dialogues, I'd receive a lot of hate mail. Yes. We've lost the picture. We've lost the plot. The heart of Islam is something else. It's not about our egos dominating or we winning the debate or not winning. We don't have that. We shouldn't even have the intention to convert people. We don't need that intention. There's no need. We don't have that instruction from the imams either. The instruction is to act as a true Muslim with non-Muslims, Jews, Christians and everything. Encountering Jews and Christians, again, the first course of action as before. Avoid being apologetic. Islam is Islam. Quran is Quran. For the name of unity, you can't come and change our beliefs. There's no need for that. Their Jews and Christians have their beliefs. We have our own. Yes, there is some commonality, so be it. And all with these dialogues with the Jews and Christians, just focus on the commonality. However, when it comes to differences of opinion, you have to be firm. Our religion says this. There's no need to try to interpret certain principles in a way just to make it more comfortable for them to accept. Because we're not there to convert them. Okay, it's a dialogue to improve, you know, we know one another, be friends with one another. These misunderstandings should be, you know, eliminated. That's it. If you don't understand, refrain from speaking. Religion is one. That's definitely a principle we have in the Holy Quran. And that's Islam. And by that we mean pure Tawheed. And these different religions that we see, in quotes, they manifest this pure Tawheed in differing dimensions. Yes, most of them, if not all, except Islam, it's distorted. But that amount which is not distorted is still valid. And they, even if it was undistorted, when you look at all the books, they still manifest pure Tawheed to differing levels. The Quran manifests Tawheed much stronger than previous books. The way the Quran explains Allah, you don't see it in other books. And all religions that came after the Quran, when they spoke about Tawheed, they said nothing that the Quran, that Nahjul Balagha, that Sahifa Sajjadiya hasn't said. They've added nothing to the concept of pure Tawheed. Avoid debating. Dialogue is good. Understanding one another is good. But debates, to be quite frank, although it has some potential, but the debater needs qualifications. And we're not seeing that. It's more of a battle amongst the egos. Debating, I would not suggest. But since it's very common in America, and they teach you that, and it's part of the university culture, I don't want to say never enter into debates, but be careful. When you say it's more of an ego thing, and you're not doing it for Allah's sake, you know, don't, you know, contaminate yourself. Interfaith dialogue is very important, But don't lose the plot. It's not about converting anyone. It's more of a socio-political tool. They're not trying to convert us, and we're not trying to convert them. We're not even trying to give the Islamic message to them. We're just trying to, on those common grounds, so that misunderstandings are lessened, we're trying to create a more harmony through these dialogues. Because those priests, rabbis and everything, they're going to go back and speak to their audiences, and they will speak positive about Islam, especially the commonalities. So here, look at it as a socio-political tool. Now, I'm not trying to say this out of disrespect at all when I say socio-political tool. Actually, socio-political tools are important. It's important to have. It's a tool to create that harmony. Nothing. Don't look at politics as a negative thing. Yes, it's been abused and everything. But politics means the management of the affairs of a community. And therefore, this is part of that process, rather than trying to convert or spread and so on and so forth. And then when it comes to encountering other Muslim denominations, again, first course of action as before, compassion and so on and so forth. Unity is the driving force and ultimate criterion to observe. And there again, that positive coping applies very much so here. Avoid debates with other Muslim denominations. Pray and fast together. Hold joint Eid prayers if feasible. The charity work, community projects, do it together. There's no need to have a Shia charity and a Sunni charity. Try and work together. If that means going under their auspices and helping them, so be it. So be it. There's no need to open a new Shia thing. What you can add to the momentum that they have. Sometimes it's necessary to open a new Shia charity. But don't think it's a must. You could go and add to the momentum of many existing charities. Yes, if those charities are with negative intentions and you're in doubt how they're spending the money, okay, there's a case there for you to start your own charity. But sometimes it's better if you find a good, let's say, charity of another denomination to add to the momentum of that charity rather than starting your own with a slow momentum. So there are many scenarios and many alternatives. I'm not suggesting one and that's it, but you can analyze the different parameters at stake. Inciting any form of hatred should be refrained from. That's a given. We shouldn't even be speaking about this kind of thing. I'm embarrassed to even speak about this kind of thing. This Sunni Shiism thing, which has developed and evolved the way it's evolved today, it was never an issue 60 years ago and before that. It was never an issue. They were together. And they would respect the Ahlul Bayt. And Sunnis and Shias, they were together. They would just have a different Sharia. That's it. And there was no sensitivity with the differing Sharias. The reason it's become so sensitive now is because of the hatred that has been spread. And this is something very unfortunate. And that positive coping is very important, especially in this case study with other Muslim denominations. And the more dignifying amongst you are those who cope more. Interdenominational gatherings, yes, and that's also of utmost importance to at least try and lessen this inciting of hatred which is happening. In some communities it's much more. In some communities it's much less. But yes, with the children you have to be very careful. This kind of inciting can have very major side effects as they grow. Okay, so I think that's it. Wassallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala tahirin. Rachel?
You were talking about the two approaches, the top-down and the bottom-up.
Yes.
According to the letter that Imam wrote to Gorbachev for the top-down approach.
Right.
And you also mentioned the Suleiman.
Yes. Right.
Similarities.
Right.
So there's no, but it's more beneficial to do the grassroots approach.
Yes. With Imam, it wasn't a top-down approach because he didn't write the letter, let's say, 20 years before the revolution at the time of the Shah. Okay. After the revolution, he mastered the grassroots. This was a fruit of that. When to write the letter, it was started with the grassroots, got the revolution, got the support of the masses. Now he speaks with the presidents. So Imam had a bottoms-up approach, Imam did. But other Sharias, we see that top-down with Nabi Sulaiman alayhi salam, and there may have been some maslahat there. But in general, though, the bottoms-up approach is something which is much more important, because once you have the support of the masses, it will be of effect. With the Holy Messenger too, the letters to the kings and everything came after having a governance, having a mass support.
One of the brothers, he sent a copy of the Quran to all the senators.
Right.
In the United States.
Yes.
The 100 senators. And according to what I heard, the FBI approached him and says, why are you sending this and all that? But it's not right. It's not the right approach. Is that right?
Well, it's not haram or anything, but it's not effective. And actually here, it even caused a sensitivity. It caused a problem with the FBI. We don't need to do that. We have to work through the margins. Once you've got the support, now you can extend. And before that, there's no responsibility.
Yes.
Sorry.
Working in a Western society, we are sometimes encountered situations which we as Muslims, we don't agree with. Sometimes it becomes important to do a job. Like you go to some meeting where it's part of your official duty, there may be alcohol with it, okay? You don't like to do that, but at the same time, you come in a difficult position. How do you handle that? You know, your religious belief and your requirement to hold a job.
Yes.
Is there some way you can help that?
Yes. Before I answer that question, because it's not purely related here, before I answer it, just one thing as an introduction or a preliminary. People are of different faiths and iman, you know, Muslims. Some are weaker, some are stronger. Some are weak in some areas and strong in other areas. But we all sin. Everyone's weak in some area. And that weak person may be strong in another area. The thing is, we're all, as long as we all try and grow stronger. Some sins are evident superficially. And then we, being very complacent people, we keep on judging the person. When that person who may be at fault with a superficial sin, maybe inside has qualities which are very strong. They don't backbite, they don't lie. And so on and so forth. So we don't want to judge anyone. Here, someone has a job. In general, that job involves going somewhere and working in an environment, in a meeting, and alcohol is on the table. Yes, this is haram, according to 99% of the maraji. There may be one who has a particular viewpoint, but everyone follows their own maraji. All the marajis, as far as I know, except one, they say this is not allowed. And even that one, he has prerequisites, but he's not a famous one, so there's no need to mention the name. Yes, it's not allowed. Now, when it's not allowed, very simply, the Jews do it very well. In communities, the Jews practice every single, the smallest of things, and they make sure all non-Jews know about it, and everyone respects it. And actually, when they go against it, they're attacked. So we have to go and say, look, in our religion, if they're sensitive with the word religion, use culture. It doesn't matter. The way you put it forward, that's up to you, your initiative. You go very and say, look, in our religion, we can't sit on a table where alcohol is being served. That either they will listen to you and adapt, or they'll tell you, you don't attend the meeting. Then when they say you don't attend the meeting, next time if the same happens and they see this is a habit, either they will adapt or they have to kick you out because you have to do work. If they kick you out, you have to say to yourself, can I find another job or not? If it's feasible to find another job, well, for Allah's sake, do it. You can't find another job. If you can't and you're limited to this, and you not having a job is going to cause significant harm to your capital, family, and so on and so forth, there may be exceptions at stake. But that are very exceptional circumstances, assuming everything doesn't work in your favor. But we have to be, yes, very simply, you know, and especially the youth who are growing in these matters of religion, tell them, sorry, we can't because of our religion, our culture, whatever. Be very open about it. And if you do it, then you're making life for the next generation easier. Then they will make it for the next generation easier, and then Islam will fall. Look, the Indian and Pakistanis in England, since there are many of them, they've intermingled so well with the British that now everyone knows there. They all know. In the meetings, they won't bring alcohol. They won't shake your hands, for example. Because they've intermingled so much. Now, America is such a big country. That intermingling is going to be at a slower rate. But it doesn't matter if it's a slower rate. As long as you just intermingle and say what your religion is, it may mean a bit of sacrifice. But generations down, do a service to your generations. This would be a righteous legacy, Baghiyatu Salihat, because by doing this, all future generations will reap the benefits of what you did. And it will never stop until the last day. You build a hospital, eventually with earthquakes, this, that, everything, that hospital will be destroyed eventually. And then your righteous legacy stops. You'll stop benefiting in the hereafter. But this kind of Baghiyatu Salat will remain to the end. Assalamu alaikum. Yes.
Please speak up. Oh, sure. So I had a couple of, I guess one question related to what you were mentioning. You talked about those who are dignifying are those who are at all.
Yes.
And you talked about kind of examples
yes.
of that and how we go about reaching that.
Yes, and yes.
Is a good way to think about that word, maybe as like a way to translate it into my own head, almost like diplomacy, but not diplomacy on the large socio-political scale, but just interpersonal diplomacy,
yep.
and EQ almost. I'm trying to think of a way to
yes.
conceptualize it.
Yeah, when I was thinking about it, it did come to my mind, pragmatist and diplomacy, and one other word too, although I did use that one word. At tolerating. But here, yes, that's what I mean. The reason I didn't use these terms was because people may get sidetracked into another meaning, which has negative connotations. But that's the heart of what I mean, yes. I don't have a problem with that. And you said there's a second question? Yes.
It was
related. All right, right, yes. Assalamu alaikum, how are you, brother? Yes.
Moral Islamic and moral or moral issue with groups working together.
The two groups working together, what did you mean? one group being a tops-down approach, one being bottoms-up?
Yeah, is there a moral or Islamic issue that you see with groups for specific purposes working together?
No, it's possible. I don't want to put a red line and say no. But with each scenario, we have to treat it as a different case study and then look at all the differing parameters. It may be a multidisciplinary approach, and then make that final decision. And the final decision, eventually, after looking at all the parameters, is it in the best interest of the Muslims or not? Yes.
So one practical question we ask you is example. So we just had we have protests where we work with different groups.
Right.
And the question that came up was that, for the sake of unity, if you want to have, can we get any group who stands on the goal that we're trying to achieve? For example, the protest was about anti-Saudi issue.
Right.
So let's say a group X, it's a non-Muslim
group. Right, right.
They are atheists.
Right.
But they are human rights activists and they want to join with this thing.
Yes.
Can we have them together and work together on that? One example.
Yeah, definitely. That's a definite. Anyone, when you focus it on such an aim, you can get anyone, any group, any person from any race, any orientation, anything. But this is, it has to be just directed to try to, because the more you attract people, you have to make sure the more specific the goal is. The more broad the goal is, then those people may come and give different interpretations. It'll cause a disunity. Be very specific that everyone, we're working towards this aim. So don't bring your own baggage. And you don't bring your baggage either. But everyone focus on a given aim. If the aim is specific, yes, you can bring anyone.
So there are no parameters where we have to exclude anyone?
No, there's no need to exclude anyone, yes. Unless, you know, that anyone is going against, yes, which that goes, it's a contradiction in terms then, yes.
No, I have a question.
Yes.
Lot of our, and it's a very sensitive issue which you didn't want to be more specific, but I just want to clarify that.
Sure, yes.
Because a lot of, especially the Indian Pakistani, I'm talking about the Urdu speeches, a major part of them are directed against the companions.
Right.
Our people are somewhat addicted to that.
Right.
Dopamine.
Yes.
get their happiness.
Yes.
And
it's a medical thing. Just with us too. Don't worry about it. Yes, yes.
Right. So how do we, in a very gentle way, how do we counteract that?
Yes.
Because these people who are addressing these issues, they're very powerful speakers.
Yes.
And they have kind of a passion about this. And
yes.
They say the program is not complete without certain ingredients.
Yes.
And we are facing, as a smaller organization, we try to discourage that.
Right.
But obviously the popularity is not there because you're not catering to the popular demands.
Right.
So how do we very nicely address these issues?
Yes. Yes, this is quite unfortunate that this is happening. And it may be inciting that hatred or sowing the seeds,
yes,
in children especially. Instead of going to those scholars or those people who are, I think we should tolerate it, that positive coping, so we don't cause further disunity, so we tolerate what they're doing. But for our own children, that education, we make sure we make them grow into a stronger entity and the next generation can at least have lesser of that. And education, we teach them the models of the Imams. The letter, the dialogue between Imam Jawad, alayhi salam, and those of other denominations has to be taught.
Is it available?
Yes, yes.
In English?
Yes. Maybe in English, maybe Sheikh Mufid's Al-Irshad maybe mentions, because he speaks about all the Imams. It's worth looking. I'm sure he mentions some of the dialogue. But the way we speak with them, yes, the Ahlul Bayt. Yes. So I think education is the key. There's no need to cause an issue. They're doing certain acts, they're saying certain things, yes, but we don't want to cause another disunity. Yes. Rather, we just focus on our own thing, education, and then the future generations, inshallah. Well, better, but that in itself is a form of tariq. Assalamu alaikum.
You mentioned something, I think in the beginning, if I'm recalling it correctly, you said that the leaders of the community should be irfani.
Right. The resident alim. Yes, should have that world view. When I say irfani, I don't mean in action necessarily, although everyone has to be irfani in action. But the world view, how they view Islam, not only as a superficial religion, not only as a letter of the law, but look at the spirit of the law. That world view is important, based on Imam Khomeini's letter. Yes.
Most of the ulama coming.
Yes.
From Najib or Qom.
Right.
Do they not get that training, or what? Because very few of them specialize. I know it takes a certain degree.
Yes.
To get to that level.
Yes.
But like, how come we don't hear, you know, more people? We were just having a discussion in the car on the way here. That why should a Shia youth ever have to go to a Sufi gathering?
Right. There should be no need, yes. Well done. Yes. And now the Sufi gathering is okay, now they're going to even Buddhist or Hindu gatherings sometimes, or reading their books and that kind of thing. Because they're looking for knowledge, they want it, they're looking for perfection. And we have it. But scholars are scared to share it. When Imam Khomeini gave that letter, he was attacked, you know, from Qom, from Najaf. Yes. Now, sometimes, but having the worldview is important. Now, it doesn't mean they necessarily have to be trained, but as long as they know about the worldview and accept it, that helps. Yes. Sure, yes. Yes.
And you said that it has come from the root
taqi,
rather than taqwa. So if you just look at the you know that concept.
No, the root is the same. Of taqwa and taqiyya, it's the same.
So if I just consider only one side like taqiyya, yes. You're saying that you know tolerating some sort of like status
right. Yes.
Until
yes.
You know situation is
yes.
Right to act.
Yes.
Properly.
Yes.
Rather than the explanation which both some other scholars, you know, give, which is close to the concept of taqwa, which is a very protected life. Don't you think that is more, you know, sort of like overarching compared to just taking one aspect of it, like, you know, tolerating status quo until, you know, the situation
yes.
That you can act?
Yes. First of all, yes, many scholars say it's taqwa, and there's no problem there, but it doesn't solve anything. Because the aim, the objective is so that we know one another. I said taqiyya, not for myself, in Usul al-Kafi, the Imams have used this interpretation. This is not my own thing. In Usul al-Kafi, Ayatollah Hasanzada has spoken about this. I've given a summary of what Ayatollah Hasanzada said. There he brought the tradition from al-Kafi. And then the Imam were highlighting the importance of this taqiyya. Not necessarily the fiqhi, in the broad sense. But you can say taqwa too. It's just that when you say taqwa, it doesn't help because it's too broad. How is it helping? What extra have you learned? Because when it says the more dignifying amongst you, taqwa is embedded in being dignifying. It's a concomitant. It's like saying water is wet. Water and wetness, they're concomitants of one another, they're corollaries of one another, of for and being even. When you say karama and dignity, taqwa is embedded in it. So it's okay though, it's a minimum, but there's more deeper meanings. That was what I was trying to. You said there was a second question?
Last question.
Yes.
Okay,
so there's one more very question. And that's basically related to the extent of cooperation with certain other groups. I have a confusion in that regard. If you just look at the lives of all the imams, in their lifetimes, there was many, uprisings.
Yes.
And some of those uprisings, people are, sensitivities are there.
Yes.
Very staunch, supposedly, their followers were involved.
Yes.
But none of those uprisings were supported by, imam of that time.
Right.
We don't see, any such thing.
Yes.
So we see that those uprisings, people used to, come to imams and they said that we agree on this goal. So on certain short-term goal, they were saying exactly the same thing which Imam said, okay? But Imam, knowing that strategically it's going to be wrong, Imam didn't support any of
right.
that. So, that's in relation to his question, Brother Mutahir's question. That he said that, if we are here, we are going to, cooperate with XYZ, we are going to cooperate with ABC. Currently, they have a common agenda. Let me be a little, specific about that. Currently, 5-6 organizations, probably one Christian, one Jewish, and some other atheist are there. They are all against Saudi operations.
Right.
We all agree on that. We are all together in a coalition. But tomorrow, they will start propagating something else.
Right.
They will start propagating. Let's say.
It's okay.
Is it okay?
Yes, because we're not propagating with them. We're propagating with them on a specific issue. Why? Because we have one thing in common. We are all mustaz'afin against the arrogant ones, the global forces of a global arrogance. We're all suppressed. When we're all mustaz'afin, the suppressed has no Muslim or non-Muslim. It's for all the suppressed people of the world. That was Imam Khomeini's message. So depending on our goal, in that specific goal, we can get anyone. If later on they do something else, we isolate ourselves from that. We won't work in cooperation with them. But in those things that we can work in cooperation, we should. Before, in your introduction to this question, the uprisings that the imams would accept or not accept. For example, in the time of the 10th imam, there were almost 13 uprisings, even though he was under house arrest. How come he gave the go-ahead with those? How come he coordinated those? This goes back with and compared with what happened in Karbala rather than what happened in Hudaybiyah, Imam Hassan's peace treaty, Amir al-Mu'mineen. Here, when Islam itself or an article of faith itself is in the brink of total destruction, here sometimes the only way is martyrdom. And that, they give the go-ahead to go ahead. Everything is at stake. But until then, no. One has to always live in taqiyyah. Taqiyyah in the broad sense, not the fiqh. Taqiyyah is part of religion. There's no religion without it. There are a lot of interesting traditions. But the thing is, we keep on limiting it to the fiqh taqiyyah. We've lost a very important tool that the imams are trying to show us.
Yeah, last question and you have a break.
Sorry.
There's a small, you said, we are supposed to know one another, let them be Jews or Hindus.
Yes.
I can give you some, I just want to find out, raise the question before.
Yes.
How are we supposed to do that? I can give you an example. I spent nearly around half my life in India and half my life here. In India, we dealt with Hindus. And
right.
They said, oh, they are kafir, you cannot even drink the water they give you, you cannot eat anything, you don't visit them, they don't visit you, they sit on the chair becomes najis.
Mm.
So avoid interact.
Yes.
Okay. Here I come to the United States. I don't know how many people, the people that at least I move around with, never invite anybody who is non-Muslim to anything, not to our house, we hardly interact, not even a neighborly relationship.
Mm.
Not even giving them things. Like most of the time, 99% of the time, at least the crowd that I move around with, including my own home, you hardly get anybody from, either Jewish or Christians and those kind of things.
Yes.
How are we going to know one another. On a superficial level, like in the workplace, okay, hi John, how are you? I'm fine, thank you. Is that what it is, or
right.
is it something more?
No, it's something definitely much more, and compassion with even Hindus, that's very important. When Imam Khomeini was in France, he was there for 6 months. It's a very interesting model there. The way he treated his neighbors and how his neighbors would come in on the premises where he was living and sit down and listen to him. You know, all types of people, even Buddhists. And there it was very easy. Now, this one thing that has badly, and it's becoming worse, has entered our mindset. And that's because of, you know, scholars maybe like me who introduce these concepts in a bad way, is there's a difference between najis on one side and being bad. They're not the same. Najis is najis. But not anything which is najis is bad. For example, a dog is not bad. It's a creature of Allah. Even if you see a dog, Islam's line is to give compassion to it. For goodness sake, Imam Hassan in front of a dog, he said, I'm embarrassed to eat, and gave his food to a dog. They said, why? He said, because it has a spirit. You see, it has a ruh. I'm embarrassed. So if a dog comes, instead of being scared and jumping to the other side of the road and shouting, even if you were to hug a dog and kiss it, it's a very good act. Because, you know, we face dogs, you know. Actually, I was walking down Georgia Road just yesterday, and a dog was coming, and I think it was a female dog, because the owner shouted, Leah, come here, yes. Anyway, Leah came and kept on sniffing me, and I said nothing. I was about to go and stroke it, to let them see that we have, you know, Americans shouldn't have this impression that we hate dogs. It's wrong. It's only najis. And najis means for certain ibadat, especially in salat, we have to abide by certain things. But it's not bad. The kafir is not bad. They're najis, and so on and so forth. With the drinking and eating from their place, fiqh has answered that. In the letter of the law, said you can eat with them in their house and everything. Unless you actually see, you're 100% sure that with a wet medium, they touch their food. Otherwise, you can always assume, you haven't seen it, you can say they used gloves. Only their meat, only meat with Hindus or non-Hindus, whatever, it has to be substantiated for you that it's slaughtered in the Islamic way. So refrain from eating their meat. And they know this. They know all this. So in the West, I mean, in India, I don't know, but it's going to be very difficult maybe in India when they have that mentality. And correcting that mentality in the East is something extremely difficult, if not impossible. But in the West, you can easily get rid of this mentality in your children. It's doable. Okay.
Yes. Maybe 10 minutes and 4:35 will come and have session 2.
So, okay.